Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. I'm your host, Dr. David O'Brien from Goldsmiths College, University of London. On this episode, I'm talking to Professor Stephen Fielding from the University of Nottingham about his new book, A State of Play, British Politics on Screen, Stage and Page, from Anthony Trollope to the Thick of It. Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. This week, I've got the pleasure of being in Manchester, in a quite cool bar, and I'm going to be talking to Professor Stephen Fielding from the University of Nottingham. About his new book, State of Play, which is a history of the representation of politics, or British politics more specifically, in all different forms of fiction over the course of the 20th century. Is that right? You gave me a quizzical look there.
Yes, I think that's a fair description. I wouldn't be suing you on the basis of that description.
I guess the place to start is maybe... how did you end up writing State of Play? Because it's, I think it's quite unusual for a political science book. And was your background in kind of literature, drama, history?
Well, the first thing is I would never claim, or I mean, I would certainly never want to be described as being a political scientist. My first degree was in history. I did a PhD that was in social history by Irish Catholics in Manchester and Salford, which strayed into the politics and the popular politics of being an Irish Catholic immigrant. And from there, I fell in with some other historians of the Second World War and wrote a book with them about popular politics. So my interest has always been in how people have related to formal politics and how formal politics is tried and usually failed to relate to popular culture. And that work on the 1940s led into the 1960s, looking at different changes that were going on in British society and how the Labour Party perceived those changes. So a lot of my work is about perception as much as reality. And then I reached a point, I was teaching at the University of Salford, and I reached a point where I realised that most students who were studying politics weren't really that interested in politics. And I was...
that's quite an awkward revelation.
Yes, I think quite a common one. So I was thinking, well, how do I get to these students and talk about politics in a way that they might be more interested in? And actually, I'd reached a point in my career where I could kind of choose what I wanted to do a bit more, and I wasn't having to chase grants, or at least I didn't feel that I should, and I wasn't didn't have to fit into any preconceived ESRC diktat about if you want to get grants, this is what you've got to do. So I felt I was free to choose and be a bit self-indulgent. I genuinely thought that to talk about films, talk about television in particular, and how they constructed how politics is, I thought that might be a way into getting them interested in it, and it actually might be a way of trying to understand why many people don't like politics, have got certain ideas about politics. So it came from that, and initially as a kind of a teaching imperative, and just a development of what I was already interested in. So I didn't have any expertise in theatre, in drama generally, in film studies. I mean, I just went in there and just started thrashing about. And I'm assuming that all the specialists, all the disciplinary.
Why I was doing that.
Okay, that was an interesting noise. I thought that maybe the people from the media studies were trying to to edit
the screaming,
close it down. The people that take it upon themselves to impose disciplinary boundaries, I'm sure they'll hate this book. And they'll say, oh, he's not doing this, he's not doing that, and he always overlooked that. Well, fair enough, but that's not the book I wanted to write.
I mean, it's interesting in a way that the book is both, I think, important academically, and the introduction makes a very clear academic point about political science, and political scientists have this problem about not understanding what politics means to citizens, whilst at the same time, certainly in reviews and kind of across the British media, it's got very favourable press, and it's been talked up by kind of various columnists and stuff like this. So you seem to have achieved something with the book that is almost unique in a way that, you know, you're talking to a set of academics about the limitations of the field, whilst like civilians want to read it as well. And was that something you were kind of conscious of when you were writing it?
Well, yeah. So there's only been one review so far that's been from an academic, and he didn't like it. Actually, there was somebody from another discipline who completely slaughtered it. But you're right. Generally speaking, from the general kind of reader and journalists and people like that, it's been welcomed much more positively. Well, I think because I'm a historian who's in a school of politics, and I'm kind of a liminal figure in terms of the discipline of politics, that I basically didn't have an investment in trying to follow the diktats of the discipline of history or politics. So I just wanted to talk to a more general audience anyway, and hopefully I was able to straddle the addressing more conventional academic concerns with actually making it accessible and allowing people who don't have the codes to work out what's being said. So that might get, you know, that, so I got a lot of the academic stuff out of the way in the introduction, and hopefully that set it up quite nicely. And then the rest of it is essentially telling a story along a set of themes that cross all those different kinds of political fictions from the late 19th century, middle 19th century to the present day.
And it's really interesting how, I guess, those themes tell us things about life in British society. They tell us things about the British political system. They tell us things about, I guess, how media functions. And one of the things that we'll talk about later on is the profound impact of political changes on the media and how they are reflected back by the media themselves when they're, you know, thinking in terms of what gets commissioned on television and stuff like this. But one thing you make, I think, abundantly clear in the introduction is that there are a kind of a bunch of standard tropes in fiction that in some ways undergo profound shifts, but actually sort of stay the same. So, for example, you talk a lot about how British political leaders are almost kind of tied up with ideas about masculinity, are presented as men, sometimes presented as pompous, are sometimes presented as kind of corrupt, are occasionally presented as honest outsiders, which initially is to do with being working class, but then becomes to do with being women and things like that. So I wonder if you could just talk through maybe the kind of the key tropes that seem to run right across the book.
Well, there's a certain misgiving about power. A lack of trust, and also a certain scepticism about the nature of democracy. Mm. About it's most of the things I look at are basically exploring the failure of popular sovereignty, the failure of representative democracy to deliver on its representative function. Now in Britain, we've famously got the mother of all parliaments. We gave the world democracy, but we've got a system which is basically it's changed and adapted from an elite way of governing the country, basically to bolt on voting, and so the primary concern, and you can see it reflected in many of the fictions actually, some particularly the earlier ones, the primary concern is to ensure the continuity of government. And that the people are disregarded and are seen as being a mob that has to be somehow or another conjoined to this wonderful machine. And you can see that right from the start in Trollope, and very severe misgivings about the nature of democracy. And you could say, well, he was writing in a pre-democratic period. But you can see these ideas, and this is interesting about fiction, because in some ways people that write fiction, some of them are actually politically engaged, some of them are actually elected politicians. But for many ways, I don't think I use the term in the book, people that write these political fictions are vernacular political theorists. So they're popularising and certain key ideas. And one of the key ideas is the incapacity of the people. There are two kind of ways, the two major tropes are really, you can't trust the politicians for all kinds of reasons, but there's another one, which is you can't trust the people. Now, the latter is kind of not disappeared completely, but in the populist kind of political culture that we now live in, one of the things you can't do is question what the people want. But certainly for well into the post-war period, and this goes with a type in certain narratives which has now almost disappeared, you have got positive depictions of the good politician, who is usually upper class, male, cool, patrician, And that person is a person that allows democracy to flourish despite the shambles and the mob-like tendencies of the people concerned, of the ordinary people. So I think those are two of the main ones. You can't trust the politicians and you can't trust the people. Playing against specific historical events, gaining legitimacy from them, but it's underlying going all the way through.
And you do show how that shifts. There isn't a kind of a continuity in the sense of the examples from Trollope and to an extent Oscar Wilde as well that you give early on in the book, where there is a sense of the need to kind of, I guess, defend the status quo from, what do you call it, you know, you sort of show how Trollope is scared of the parties, the press, the people in general, women in particular,
yes.
And how these things would become more important. But by the time we get later on into sort of 1980s, 1990s, this sense of being fearful of people that in Michael Dobbs' House of Cards, for example, almost becomes a sense of, well, you, the people, are complicit in all of this as well. You know, we're not going to fear you anymore because social and economic changes, but the things you're moaning about are your own fault. You know, and it's really interesting that even that continuity shifts as well.
Yes, there's a Dennis Potter television play called Vote, Vote, Vote for Nigel Barton, which the BBC finally broadcast in 1965 after having a lot of misgivings about it. And it's essentially about the demoralisation of an idealistic Labour Party candidate in the Safe Tory seat fighting a by-election. Now, Dennis Potter, the year before, had fought in the Safe Conservative seat for the Labour Party. And for him, it was a kind of epiphany. And it put him off politics, formal politics, for the rest of his life. But there's a key scene towards the end, because what it shows is how terrible local parties are. There's a cynical, and the key character really is a cynical agent. He was a standard figure going all the way back to Disraeli through Trollope, and the agent is often the heart of darkness in the political process, fixing things, even all the way back to Dickens and Pickwick Papers and the Eatanswill by-election of 1837. But what Potter does very, very unusually is has the agent towards the very, very end, after the viewer has seen how terrible politics is, to look at the camera and essentially to say, you're to blame, to the viewer. And that doesn't happen very often. It happens in different ways. And Charlie Booker in the Waldo moment, in his comic dark satiric dystopian Channel 4 series from 2013, has a similar kind of thing where the stupid people are seen to be complicit in the awfulness of politics. And, you know, both Potter and Charlie Brooker are basically saying this is not a good situation, but the people are complicit in it as well. It's very unusual. Nowadays, it's populism, that the people are betrayed, that it's the politicians who are part of a conspiracy, whether it's one that's just of their own making or one involving Washington, if it's in the 1980s during the Cold War, or global companies nowadays in the neoliberal world in which we all live, but they're part of a conspiracy against the people. Which is developing a thing that was kind of there, certainly in films and in comedies of the early 20th century. It's kind of an interesting development, trying to place where the people are in this process. And as I say, they were a threat in terms of Trollope in the early days, when Westminster politicians were trying to deal with the extension of the franchise. They were disregarded and feared in some ways also by socialists, like George Orwell and his depiction of the proles.
And also, actually, in Chapter 3, it's really interesting where you talk about how two writers that should be absolutely opposed on everything, Evelyn Waugh and Jimmy Priestley, they share a similar, if not outright hostility to the people, but certainly this kind of fear and suspicion of, are they really capable of being put in charge?
Yes. I think with Evelyn Waugh, it was an outright hostility. But J.B. Priestley, who was meant to be the voice of the people during the Second World War, in the People's War, and encourage people to vote Labour and to embrace a new future after the war, in his novels of the wartime, it's as if he can't actually imagine the people themselves doing politics. It's about getting them to vote Labour. and then shut up, yeah. Basically. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's, but I think in that way that you can, what that shows, and what other fiction show, is the nature of, the peculiar nature of British political culture, that it does disregard popular agency, and yet at the same time, you do get, in the same way you get in the United States, Mr. Smith goes to Washington, and the outsider coming in and cleaning house and exposing corruption and dealing with the system, because of course you can't rely on the politicians to do that, so you have to rely on a Boy Scout from the middle of nowhere, James Stewart, to go and do it. And insofar as that was a character that in American political fiction was actually quite common, and went on to become even more common after the Second World War, then in Britain this kind of populist figure becomes much more apparent, a much more popular populist figure. So the misgivings about the people are kind of fade away as the elite, I think it may be. Kind of maybe that one of the explanations, the political elite starts to lose faith in itself. Then these fictions are of, and where the outsider, as you were saying, first of all, in Britain anyway, it's the working class, then the women. They're not so much ethnic minorities as is the case in the United States, where the outsider is of that nature. That becomes much more apparent because the elite themselves lose faith in themselves, but also the people out there lose faith in the elite to solve those problems.
And it's interesting how this happens later in the sense of, if one was telling, a sort of standard post-war story about Britain, you'd say, you know, the height of the importance of the people, however we define them, is 45, is the kind of transformation of Britain under the Labour government, the post-war settlement. But you're really, really, articulate in the book, where you talk about, well, actually, this is a bit of a romantic myth to an extent, that although there were high levels of votes for two main political parties, no more than 10% of the population was actually a member of the political party, and really the sort of post-war settlement is to do with, if not rejecting populism, but saying it's time to go back to the supremacy of Westminster. And in some ways this is represented by hostility to certain bits of the Labour Party. You give the example of the party manners kind of controversy over how Labour are represented, but also it's to do with, I guess, a sense that both political parties have that kind of disconnection from popular politics.
Yes, I mean, to some extent, this is benefiting from the work that I did prior to moving into fiction in terms of popular culture and the Labour Party in the Second World War, 40s and into the 60s. There were attempts within the Labour Party to try and engage and to mobilise the people in a more active way, which didn't really lead to anything very much. Hugh Gaitskell in the early 1950s kind of very useful kind of speech to sum up a certain attitude. Hugh Gaitskell was just about to become the leader of the Labour Party when he made this speech, and he recognised that many people in Britain at this point in time didn't think the politics was a good thing, that it was a place where bad things happened, that the parties were all the same. I mean, he actually mobilised many of the arguments that people have got today about how people perceive politicians. But what he said was, but these people are wrong, they are ignorant, and just dismissed it. That Hansard Society, which does a lot of good work today in Britain about trying to sort of promote a better knowledge of how Parliament exists, was formed in 1944 by Stephen King Hall, because he recognised, as did other people during the Second World War, that there was a loss of faith in established authority, that there were lots of independent, anti-political candidates, the people that rejected the way that Britain was governed and winning seats. And he basically saw the Hansard Society as a way of just educating people into understanding how things really work. So there's a kind of a faith there about the virtues of the Westminster system. But they're clearly recognising that faith is amongst the elite, and it doesn't really percolate out there to ordinary people. They're voting. And why they're voting in great numbers is a question that's interesting, but it isn't necessarily because they have this unalloyed faith that everything is going to go right because they're voting for Clement Attlee or Winston Churchill. There is a scepticism there, which which many of these fictions are tapping into, and a mistrust, which becomes bigger and greater as that post-war period develops.
And I guess it becomes bigger and greater with some seriously profound changes in telecommunications, particularly television, and to an extent the decline of cinema. And it's really interesting in the book that, at least in my understanding of the book, the kind of the key moment for television isn't really the 50s, because you're talking a bit about, you know, numbers of people owning and stuff like this. It seems to be the 60s where you get a satire boom, you get kind of mass television consumption, and I suppose, you know, you draw on this a little bit as well. You get a particular group of elites who are willing to sort of have a go at themselves. So you mentioned kind of in passing things like that was the week that was, the birth of Private Eye, which is a satirical magazine, and that kind of, I guess, moment of, you know, there are scandals going on in Parliament, there are questions about the parliamentary elite, and seemingly, what was it you call them? Is it Tory anarchists or something like
that? Yes, not my phrase, but yeah. Yes, it's a useful phrase. Well, I think the big change is in censorship, which actually does occur at the same time. And you can see the two things, you know, increasing propensity to satirise those with authority of all kinds, and the decline of censorship and the lifting of prohibitions as being quite important. And that the role of the media, television media in particular, really becomes much more significant. Because in the 1950s, when it was just the BBC, and even when it was ITV as well, the independent channel, they were censored in a kind of an informal way, so that they didn't see it as their job to undermine the political system. You could say it was something to do with the Cold War, but it was also an entrenched kind of deference. Many of the people that were running the BBC and ITV were the very same people that were running the political party. So it was all part of a cosy little thing. And so it was very difficult. Sometimes it happened, but it was very difficult to get anything that was critical of politicians. You could do it in comedy, but by and large, that was about it. And as I've already mentioned, Dennis Potter, who was himself, you know, a member of the Labour Party, it was a kind of a dark comedy about an election campaign. He had to change his programme in different ways. There were various cuts. And he claims that someone from the BBC during this process just turned around and asked him, "Are you a fascist?" Just because he was gently, it wasn't like, anyway, he was criticising aspects of the party system. And so that, the prohibitions are lifted. So there's a kind that, so you can say more. But also, one of the biggest changes is in the later 80s, 90s, when the regulatory regime, in terms of the financing of ITV, changes, so that they have to, the commercial companies have to basically make as much money as possible through advertising, and they really do have to chase audiences. And that takes the BBC, which has to gain legitimacy in terms of government, in order to defend the licence fee and to try to justify increasing it, has to get audiences. And up to this point, you would get, side by side with sitcoms that were illustrating the flawed relationship between the people and politicians in very popular sitcoms like Steptoe and Son, but many, many others. You would also get drama series in the 1970s and the 60s about how there were decent people in Parliament, there were good men who were trying their best under difficult circumstances to represent the people. And there were many of them, some of them on ITV. They disappeared almost overnight because in some ways, they didn't get audiences. And so they wanted to, and politics isn't the most popular of subjects and never has been. It's a drama and comedy. So as a drama series that basically says what nice guys these politicians are, you're not going to get that many people. And given that the impetus of the commissioning editors is to get audiences, how do we get audiences? And they then start to very, very consciously mine what they think the people want, which is conspiracies, dark-hearted villains, the bad side of politics. And interestingly enough, when you do, because after the 2001 general election, which was figure in my head is 59.4% of the British electorate voted in the general election of 2001. That's set at kind of a moral panic amongst the electorate, amongst the elite, to say, what are we doing? This is the lowest ever participation rate. Is democracy coming to an end? What will happen to us all? The BBC came up as part of its remit, because it still had a kind of a public service remit, still got a weak public service remit, came up with a few attempts series that did promote the idea of politicians as being not as bad as you might think. And they didn't get audiences. They were misunderstood, that they were actually taken to be examples of the cynical dramas that they were trying not to be. So there's by that point, it's an entrenched audience perception that whatever is about politics is always about corruption and then the dark hearted villains. So even when you're presenting something in which that isn't the case, that's how it's seen.
Yeah, the rise of particularly a conspiracy thriller, it is really fascinating because I suppose much like the rise of elite satire willing to kind of have a go at itself, it's not something that comes just out of the 1970s as a problematic and difficult time in British society and British politics. It's something that is bound up with transformations in the media landscape itself. And fascinatingly, actually, Channel 4 is really crucial in all of this, but not in the way of kind of giving space for, I suppose, what we might think of as kind of serious drama, but actually giving space to quite racy, quite interesting, quite exciting thrillers that are grounded in much of the kind of conspiratorial ideas. But in turn, these conspiracies have, I guess, a kind of a longer route. And one of the examples you give, which I actually was quite fond of as a sci-fi geek growing up, is Quatermass. And I wonder if you'd say a bit about that and maybe its relationship to something like Defence of the Realm or a very British coup, which, you know, happened 30 years later.
Mm. Well, yeah, the rise of the conspiracy is of the conspiracy drama is interesting. And as you say, it's bound up with all kinds of cultural developments. But in terms of outlining in a drama, in a dramatic form, the idea that politicians are not necessarily representing the popular interest, but maybe another interest, which is hidden, which is kind of one of the abiding themes of political drama. It comes and it goes. It didn't need the 1970s and subsequent events for it to be there, but it developed much more strongly. Yeah, that the conspiracy, certainly on television, which, as I say, was quite heavily censored in the 1950s, and Quatermass 2, the second of the Quatermass trilogy, which was about an honourable scientist trying to do good and find out the truth of everything, which was broadcast in 1955, is essentially an anticipation of the invasion of the body snatchers, in which aliens take over the bodies of humans. But the thing about it is that it's about aliens taking over the bodies of the Prime Minister, top civil servants, and establishing secret government germ warfare factories, which, of course, that's what the real government was doing in the 1950s. And Nigel Neill, who wrote Quatermass, was interested in what was going on in the secrecy, what was really going on behind those barbed wire fences. And in Quatermass 2, the answer is, there are a series of alien feeding stations which are to help the alien invasion and to take over of Earth. So basically, you can think, well, what's that got to do with politics? But he's basically feeding off a contemporary political issue, secrecy in the Cold War. What is government doing? A lack of trust in the motives of government. But of course, you can get that on the BBC, and it's very, 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 very popular series. Because it isn't really about politics, it's science fiction. And you can get away with, like in comedy, you can say things because people just think, oh, it's comedy, isn't it? But if you said the same thing in a drama, then you'd be censored. Or if it's a contemporary drama set in the present day dealing with a real issue. So the conspiracy was there being expressed, but in a very elliptical, sideways form. And that continues to be the case. And it's set in the future, science fiction setting, Doctor Who also picked up on certain things that, you know, you couldn't say if it was a drama in the 1960s. And in some ways, you know, that's an ever-present thing, but it kind of really takes off the conspiracy as a drama, which is depicting in real time, contemporary, or just set a year or two ahead of real time, with real politicians in a real Westminster setting, we're not making this up, kind of thing, is in the 1980s. which is partly a response of left-wing dramatists to write kind of sexy, popular stories and chase an audience. But the other is also to advance their own idea of how things are actually happening, which is, and the most famous one, I think the first of the most famous ones is the novel written by Chris Mullin, the Labour of far left. He becomes an MP, but at this point in time, he's a supporter of Tony Benn, active, prominent supporter of Tony Benn. And in the early 1980s, there was an attempt to turn the Labour Party into a radically socialist vehicle that would unilaterally disarm, that might leave NATO, might leave the EU, become kind of neutralist, nationalise all sectors of the economy. The very opposite of Thatcher, as what would actually happen. But Mullin wanted to imagine what might happen if this kind of government got elected. And he wrote this novel, which the government gets elected, but then is undermined by the British military, the establishment, the BBC, the Americans, and it's implied very strongly at the very end that there's a kind of quiet coup. It's not like Chile, but the effect is that the democratic elected government has just been replaced by one that's more amenable. And when Tony Benn reads it and reviews it, he says this is how it could be. You know, so it's actually, there's a sort of political culture on the left that sees society and sees politics in these ways. But that becomes merges into a much more mainstream view of politics, which it does actually ironically tap into this more populist, apolitical, or possibly right-wing kind of perception, which it all kind of goes into one.
Because the same fears are really obviously present in the great kind of triumphant political comedy of the right, or perhaps the centre-right, yes. Which is Yes Minister and then Yes Prime Minister, where, a sort of hapless, to an extent, idiotic minister is depicted as being, however well-intentioned or however, you know, interesting his policy ideas, thwarted by this great establishment that, in the Yes Minister case, is kind of protecting those forces that the left are seen to be critical of, but perhaps protecting them, I suppose, in a different way for different reasons.
Yes, well, there's a line in the conspiracy film Hidden Agenda, in which someone who's leading a conspiracy says to the honest copper who's trying to expose it, well, all politics is a conspiracy, and Yes Minister kind of feeds into that idea that civil service, in particular, is a self-interested force that will always subvert the popular will. If democracy is meant to be the expression of popular sovereignty, why are the people never sovereign? Which is one of the standard questions which political fictions seek to answer, or at least highlight the problem. If they never really quite answer them because it's complicated. It would be very complicated, very dull. Not many people would want to, but they highlight the program. That's highlight the problem in different ways. Yes Minister's kind of highlighting of it, which fed into what a lot of people were thinking in the 1970s, was there were these vested interests in the state, and the civil service was the leading element of it. The trade unions were as well, which would constantly subvert whichever party was in office and would do their own thing. And they would fleece the honest taxpayer and use their money to featherbed their own kind of lifestyles. And Yes Minister was kind of interesting because, I mean, it was co-written by somebody who wrote speeches for Margaret Thatcher and even in the end was knighted by Margaret Thatcher. And himself was very strongly influenced by kind of public choice economics and was quite explicit about that. And the person that co-wrote it, Jonathan Lynn, claimed to be from this early 60s satire. I mean, he was kind of that generation that came after Footlights and after Monty Python, and was a kind of, he thought of himself as this freewheeling radical where all politics is a conspiracy, but didn't have a right-wing agenda. Although I did come across a letter in the Thatcher papers of him congratulating Margaret Thatcher on a 1983 victory, which in itself was interesting. But certainly the way that Margaret Thatcher appropriated the comedy and identified with it and let it be known this was her favourite show, because it basically was coterminous with what she thought. So there's different kinds of conspiracies. There's a right-wing conspiracy, there's a left-wing conspiracy, there's all manner of conspiracies, but they all kind of go back to the same root, which is you can't trust people with power. And those fictions kind of tread those boards again and again. As the context changes, the nature of the conspiracies change. I become much more explicit. And also by the time our own day, and certainly with New Labour becomes part of a conspiracy, but instead of having actors playing fictional politicians, that's playing Tony Blair. It's actually Tony Blair that's being depicted.
Before we talk about New Labour, because New Labour sort of is where a lot of these trends and changes can come together really interestingly. Basically, all we've talked about so far has been men. And partially this is because, as you say at the start of the book, you know, the way fiction picks politics is almost always with kind of men as its kind of key players, and women's roles tend to be things like politicians' wives, or later on as radical outsiders, maybe independent councillors and stuff like this. And it's really interesting how both the role of women in political fiction changes, but also how things that we might think would be major influences on the depiction of women, particularly Margaret Thatcher's premiership, don't have, or perhaps only have, a limited effect, particularly in political fiction written by, in the 80s and 90s, many of the people who were in her government or on her backbenches at the time. So I wonder if you could maybe describe the kind of like changing role and status of women in British political fiction.
Yeah, well, to some extent, political fiction has some relationship to political reality.
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously, the book starts in a period where no women don't have the vote, and there's a very strong normative view that women should not be involved in public life at all, of whatever description. And so some of these political fictions reflect that. And so, you know, Trollope's basically shows the disasters that may befall the political system if women get involved. And there are others, however, that see women as having a role, but it's a very clearly sort of patriarchal, separate spheres argument, that the role of women is to inspire in the private sphere their husbands, who go out into the public domain and are active in it and then come back and are then morally replenished by these angels, who have got no actual role in politics apart from that. So there's a kind of the way in which politics is represented in fiction does reflect broader ideas about their women's role in politics. And one of the interesting things is the suffragette literature that's produced before the First World War, which is obviously part of the campaign. Suffragettes were very explicit in writing plays and in one case, a novel, that were propagandists to try to make the case for why women should have the vote. But the suffragettes, at least in terms of those that produce the fictions, see women as the angels who will transform politics, because, of course, all women are caring, all women are nurturing, all women, you know, they've got higher spiritual natures than men. And so they will improve politics in that way. And actually, that doesn't really ever go away. Even today, if you just jump right to the present day, the idea of women and the role of women in politics, because the problem in politics in many of these fictions is it's the man. It's masculinity that's a problem. It's these silly, middle-aged, pugilistic idiots who are kind of sexually incontinent and whatever. They're the problem. We need women to cleanse the political system in this way, or bring the sense of the housewife, like in The Amazing Mrs. Pritchard. I mean, these are inherently sexist dramas and perceptions, but they're saying that they're actually also trying to be politically correct. So it's very interesting, the confusion that's going on there. So from being a potential threat in the late 19th century, women are being presented as a solution. But actually, the solution isn't a new thing. It's a kind of a suffragette notion of how women and men are different. Now, the interesting thing about Margaret Thatcher is that And it's kind of interesting how her left-wing critics depicted her. David Hare, in particular, sort of the famous radical playwright of the middle class in the National Theatre, wrote a series of plays in the 1980s and into the 90s in which he depicted female conservative MPs who were clearly modelled on Margaret Thatcher. And the point about them was that they were not real women, because Margaret Thatcher was not a real woman. Because if she was a real woman, she wouldn't be supporting and advocating all the policies that, as she was doing in the 1980s. So they've often got a character who is this another woman, but who represents women as they really are, you know, true women, nurturing, caring, self-sacrificing. So in many ways, Thatcher doesn't make any. I mean, personally, Thatcher was not interested in promoting other women.
No,
anyway.
No.
She couldn't give a monkey's about that kind of thing.
And you comment as well on numbers of women in Parliament.
Yes, which doesn't change at all until the New Labour period. So the discourse around women is kind of an interesting reflection on the reality of it, and the conservatism actually of many of the cases that are made for increasing the number of women in Parliament. I mean, there are many reasons for why you should want to have a more representative legislature, but many of them are actually based on inherently sexist notions about what a woman is.
Yeah, and we see this, I guess, kind of nuanced a little by the rise of particular kinds of identity politics, but again, not fundamentally sort of undermined. And interestingly, by the time we get to the age of New Labour conspiracy, shamelessly give away the twist at the end of the book, and then subsequently the film Ghost.
Oh, the Ghost Writer.
But the female character in that is presented as being part of the conspiracy.
Yes.
And almost as part of the problem.
Well, yes. I mean, the woman gone wrong. Margaret Thatcher was a woman gone wrong. She was a man. She was a man in a woman's body. So that's a woman who is true to her nature, as being a carer and a sharer and a self-sacrificing person. She's often, latterly, but even from the 1940s as well, she is the one who will help cleanse politics as the outside figure. But there are women, and this is it's like the Lady Macbeth character, which may be tapping into that. But it's more than simply that. It is about women who are not true to their nature, their supposed nature. In the same way that there were very, very rare, but one or two examples of in the 1950s and 1960s of gay political characters, male homosexuals, and they are something always goes badly wrong because they're not real men, so they're kind of unstable or whatever. Something goes wrong because they're not real, truly natural men. Now, again, with them, it's a kind of minor thing. That gay characters in political British political fiction, just as in American political fiction, actually, they become the politically correct angels. They're part of the solution now. They're not part of the problem, as they would have been seen in quite a few dramas. So again, it's quite interesting, very crude, but because of changing perceptions of sexuality, it's kind of almost gone the other way. There must be bad gay characters, but nowadays I can't think of any. But there are loads 20, 30, 40 and beyond years ago.
And I guess, I mean, I was going to ask you this at the end, but this comes up in one of the things in the book is that, you know, you take all forms of fiction seriously. So there isn't a division between what we might think of as, you know, elite forms of fiction, you know, that are just Trollope or just Dickens or whatever, and then just theatre plays. And one of the particular kind of popular or trash things is this Mistress of Downing Street, which I just found hilarious, the description of that, of, you know, what do you call it, a very well-endowed American president.
Black American
which
president.
Just hilarious. And the kind of, you know, failures of these failed men and these failed women as well. And I guess there isn't an equivalent of something like that now. There isn't, that level of stereotyping with that level of failure attached to it.
Well, yeah, you've kind of caught me out there. I can't think of one. I mean, it is Oh, I don't think I would ever use the term trash. It's not necessarily the best constructed of stories, but kitsch is often more evocative and more useful to what, because it's trading on popular stereotypes. So that's one reason why I like popular. I mean, there's a definite bias towards the popular because there's a kind of a logic. I mean, it's part of genre theory. Mm. You know, people wouldn't be producing this tripe if it wasn't popular. And so it's saying something to somebody about something.
But there's a position issue as well that you identify quite early in the book. It might be in the introduction or the first chapter where there is this kind of tension between the idea that, can we have great works that are taking politics seriously, or are we doomed to have political fiction that is just, regurgitating caricatures and, therefore shouldn't be studied by anyone because somehow it's just, genre fiction or there are just standard characters or something like this.
Yes. Well, my interest was in the standard characters and the recurring narratives, the repetitions, the rip-offs. I mean, why was it that certain things have been said again and again by the same types of characters? Like I mentioned the agents all the way back from Disraeli up to the present day. Why is it that character is like that? So in many ways, I'm not that interested in innovative fiction because it is innovative and it would be for an elite and it is trying to say something new and it's very idiosyncratic. It's to do about the individual person writing it. Very interesting, though that may be. That's kind of not my thing because I want, essentially, because I've got this idea that fiction in all its manifestations, has got a relationship with popular sentiment, that these narratives help construct the popular narrative of real things, which obviously a lot of people, constructivist, qualified constructivist is what I am, I suppose. So it's kind of a standard view. So, but the problem for people that take fiction seriously, and there are some in political theory, is that they only look at the elite stuff, because that's where these ideas are being expressed in their most limpid and clear form, and that's great, but these aren't selling, these aren't being adapted for TV, these aren't on the cinema screen, and therefore they're of interest, but to me they're not of massive interest.
There isn't that connection between, I guess, how people are voting and those forms.
Or not voting, and the reasons why. Yes, yeah.
I think a good place to conclude is New Labour, because obviously that's towards the end of the book, and it's also where the trends that you identify of both changes in how politicians are represented, changes in how media, whether literature, television, or whatever, functions, and also, really basic things about how drama is written, like the comfortableness of casting actors as living politicians, which, isn't going on in the 50s and 60s, but, people are very comfortable with having Blair Brown played by, very good British actors. So I guess the kind of the really obvious comedy is the thick of it, which is in some ways wildly successful, but is only getting comparatively smaller audiences and has a very particular view of politics set against what is, I guess, a kind of slew of contemporary dramas that take place on screen and stage. And I just wonder if you can maybe compare and contrast things like The Deal, which is a drama about Blair and Brown's quest for the Labour Party leadership, and Thick of It. Are they saying the same thing about contemporary politics? Are they saying different things?
Well, in many ways, and it goes back to the idea of these stereotypical cliché ideas being expressed again and again. The New Labour period is associated with that, with a period of spin, which is just another variation of why we shouldn't trust politicians, of them lying to us. It's just that the technology and the form and the word used is different. And in some, well, the thick of it is based on a proposition, and a very simple one, and it's based on, it originates in a very particular period. It's the period of the run-up to the Iraq War, an immediate aftermath, when weapons of mass destruction were mooted and then never discovered. And the interpretation of that by Amano Iannucci, the producer and the main writer of The Thick of It, was that the British people were deliberately lied to. They were spun into a war for reasons that were completely false. So he's made a political judgment. There's a moral judgment in that. And at the heart of politics today is about, based on lying, it's based on manipulation of perception rather than substance, reality, policy, actually doing anything. And that's clearly baked, and a lot of people agreed with that. I mean, it's many people on the left, at least, believed in that. But it's a political judgment, and that spawns a comedy. Yes Minister, just to compare that, Yes Minister was based on the assumption that the state was a kind of a vampiric force sucking the taxpayer dry, and the solution to Britain's economic problems was to reduce the size of the state and to break up the state and to introduce the market. Again, a very strong normative political notion that was then the basis for a comedy. So the New Labour era is a kind of a development in a different... The details are different, but the basic narrative sort of force is the same. It's these people are lying to us, they're screwing us, and trying to come up with an explanation. Now, The Thick of It, which I really enjoyed when I first started watching it, which is before I started even thinking about writing this book, the more I then was able to see all the other things that were being produced at the same time about New Labour, and also how politics had been depicted in earlier periods, I just realised that this is, it's shaky cameras, it's semi-improvised, there are some great performances, Peter Capaldi, and obviously the Tucker character itself, it goes beyond that particular series. But actually, it's not saying anything new, except it's saying it in a new form. But the interesting thing is it's saying it to a much more, a diminishing audience, because I think in the book by saying we've reached a pretty pass when a comedy series which is attacking politicians in this kind of way isn't being watched anymore. And the thick of its audiences, that it was first of all put on a minority, the BBC4 sort of digital channel, and then it was towards the end put on BBC2. It was never getting audiences of more than a million, much less than a million. Less than Dad's Army repeats, and Dad's Army's been going, being repeated since the 1970s. Contrast that with Yes Minister on BBC One, although initially it was put on BBC Two, which was a middle-class channel, very explicit middle-class channel in the 1970s, 1980s, and getting audiences of 9 to 15 millions or whatever. And that says a lot about the different way in which the media is operated, but also it says a lot about what the broadcasters feel able to show and to whom, and who is willing to watch stuff about politics. So I kind of end up with the conclusion that things have gone to a certain, gone to such a level that people don't even want to watch things which are slagging off politicians, let alone praising politicians.
And in terms of sort of the thing I took from the discussion of drama quite strongly was the continuity between, the use of political fiction as a way of talking about characters where there is some politics in the background, and again, that kind of trilogy of The Deal, The Queen, I can't remember what the other one is. There was a third one.
Special Relationship.
Yes, yeah.
Yes.
And these are stories about interesting characters,
Yes.
Stories about complicated situations and relationships that aren't really to do with politics, but are perhaps more character pieces. And in a way, there might be possibly a retreat from, this is how politics works. Here is how we will educate you in the, trollop sense of, giving you a window in.
Mm.
And we're going back to those elements of trollop that are to do with, is a good yarn, is a good character.
Well, the interesting thing is that Trollope, when he wrote, it was clear that he was basing some of his characters on some real politicians, and critics speculated, and they said, well, that character's clearly Disraeli, and they assumed it was Disraeli, right? But it was never Disraeli, and it was written, so there was always a distance between what he was saying and the reality, and yes, he was telling what he thought were good stories. I think Trollope's terrible, actually, but never mind on that front. But these are on the screen, and it's Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, right? And we are seeing these characters behind the scenes. We know what they look like in the front of the camera, because we were seeing them all the time. But these are purporting to tell us what happened behind the scenes. Now, they're telling us what the dramatist thinks or cares to think. And, you know, clearly there is some reality mixed up in that, but it's dramatized. It's drama, documentary. That's the hybrid form, which is possibly the most interesting aspect of all of this. And it's about how fiction about politics are now merging with the reality of politics. Because how do people consume politics? Do they consume it now? They're not active in it. They watch it. They watch it on the TV screen. Where are they seeing these dramas? On the TV screen. Now, we know, because there are studies and there's anecdotal evidence, when people watch these drama documentaries, when they see Anthony Chin playing Tony Blair, they see Tony Blair. That will have a carryover into how they perceive Tony Blair. Now, the interesting... Now, the Peter Morgan trilogy, which are all these Tony Blair's things, he's got a very strong normative notion of what Tony Blair is, which is just... he's unprincipled, and he will say anything to achieve greater and greater power, and he's obsessed with the media. He's a superficial... lack of substance. People just flow with power. Right. Now, I don't know what the real Tony Blair is. He's obviously a very peculiar man. I don't want to comment on that. But I don't see why Peter Morgan has got this accurate insight into the real Tony Blair. As far as many people are concerned, at least those that have watched these things, that's as good a version of Tony Blair as the real one, because who knows what the real one is. So that there is something that's... And it's all about the mediaization of society and how we view the world now through screens of different kinds and not reality, so far as we ever did engage with reality through reality. But I think it says that's kind of the power of these fictions. But those are fictions, you know, there's drama documentaries made about all kinds of subjects that change how we see the past and the present and politics and anything else that you care to mention.
Yeah, there's a wonderful moment in the book where I think it's a quote from Jeffrey Howe talking about a drama documentary about the fall of Thatcher, where he says, anytime he's in it, he's like, no, it didn't happen like that. That's not accurate. As soon as he goes off screen, he says something along the lines of, I totally believed everything.
Oh yeah, that's why Peter did that. Or said, oh, yeah, he's drawn into it and he believes, you know, he thinks he believes that's what they say. So, yeah, And David Blunkett was a victim of one of these New Labour drama documentaries, a comedy drama documentary, and he said in his diary that people that he knew thought that the events in it were true, and people that knew him, and so he got very frustrated. So yeah, the beguiling power of the screen is it's not a new thing, but it's the way in which the boundary between fact and fiction, and the way that censorship just allows people. To say what they want. And sometimes, and certainly the production companies that are behind some of these, sometimes often very funny, very good as pieces of work, dramas or comedies. They claim to have an explicit kind of mission to expose politicians. So they've got a political agenda too.
And that impact, I think, is... You know, if we didn't need all the reasons we talked about for people to read the book, but that impact, I think, is a really crucial one, why it's important to take the role of fiction seriously in the study of politics.
Well, that's what I tell the students at Nottingham who are the lucky ones who do the course when it runs. I say, well, you know, you're not going to be learning anything about how Parliament works and how whips operate and all of that, but hopefully... When you go out and you watch these things, you'll at least be able to ask questions and be less naive and more critical about, well, why are they saying that about this? Why, you know, is that really how Tony Blair was? You know, to actually raise critical questions. And given that this is how most people consume politics, or at least an increasing number of people compared to television news, which nobody watches and whatever, this is an important form of political communication. So yeah, it's kind of civic education is what I'm aiming at here, which is probably going to put off a lot of people from ever buying the book. But hopefully, it's better than that.
And are you doing more of this in the future, or are you going to do something sort of completely different? At the end of the book, you say, you know, we've just scratched the surface on this, so it suggests that there are more books to come. But you know, is there a different research agenda in the future?
Well, I decided, I mean, so far as many people in the discipline of politics is concerned, this is esoteric stuff, you know, what I'm doing. So I've decided to become more esoteric still. So I'm looking at period dramas, because in the book there are various there's a number of period dramas are referred to. Period dramas, which do talk about real historical characters, in particular Churchill, but period dramas of the 1970s and the extent to which they created a vision of the past that was basically moulded by the present.
Yeah.
And to try to locate them in the crisis of social democracy and the supposed transition to Thatcherism and neoliberalism in the subsequent decade. So it kind of is looking at one particular form and trying to look at the evidence in much more detail than I could possibly have done in this book, about audiences, about critics and the role of critics in constructing how people perceive these things, and trying to locate in the wider kind of political events of the day, because there's a very simplistic view, and I won't name the historian Dominic Sandbrook, who comes out with it, which is really all period dramas reduced to upstairs, downstairs, and the upstairs, downstairs is a very conservative, class conscious, very conservative period drama, and that kind of feeds into the rise of Thatcher, which at many, probably at every single level, is wrong. So I want to look at how history is dramatised, how politics is fictionalised in that particular form, at that particular time.
Cool. I look forward to reading.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. I've been your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien, from Goldsmiths College, University of London. On this episode, I was talking to Professor Stephen Fielding from the University of Nottingham about his new book, State of Play, British Politics on Screen, Stage and Page, from Anthony Trollope to the Thick of It.